Confidentiality, next subject. The great need for confidentiality in people ministry. And it's always assumed that nothing will go any further in what's being said than you and your spouse. However, it doesn't have to go that far. You've got to learn about your spouse in this regard too, haven't you? Some spouses can't keep their mouths shut. Some can. If your spouse can't keep his or her mouth shut, then don't tell them anything. If your spouse is good at keeping their mouth shut, well, tell them whatever you want to. It's fairly important to be able to learn that about your spouse. Very important. The best kind is my kind of spouse, who doesn't want to ever know. So when I say, oh, I've got something to tell you, she says, well, I don't want to know. I say, well, all right, I'll... Very frustrating at times. Can't work out how you can be so disinterested. However, you must never allow, though, people to draw you into confidentiality away from your spouse. So if you say to me, Philip, I want to tell you something, but you mustn't tell Helen, well, the answer is I don't want to hear what you've got to say. I mean, unless it's a surprise party you're organising for Helen or something like that, unless it is manifestly in her interest, I am never going to be caught by being drawn into a relationship with you which is closer than my relationship with my wife. That's death's doornail, that one. You must never allow that to happen. If I can't tell my wife, then don't tell me. Now, I'm not going to tell my wife everything I'm told anyway, now that you know. She doesn't want to know anyway. It won't let me tell her. But it's got to do with our relationship. You cannot be closer to me than my spouse, and telling secrets is the way in which people manipulate you into being closer than your spouse. Don't fall for it ever, especially with a member of the opposite sex. Especially with a member of the opposite sex. Most people do need a safety valve when they're told secrets that they can't cope with, especially lots of them. For your sake, sometimes you need a safety valve. If you know no other one, then you've got to come and talk to me or to Lois or to Cole or to Derek. Derek's a good one to talk to about it. And sometimes you need to say, look, I just got to talk to someone about it, because of the things I've heard, I am having difficulty with emotionally. And unless I talk about it, I just can't get it out of my head. Now, we're all different in this regard. But you're not talking about it in terms of gossiping about the other person. You're talking about it in terms of you coping with the information, dealing with the information. What do I mean? Well, again, the women folk often need help in this regard more than the men, because you are better listeners. You are more sympathetic by nature. You get told a story of sex abuse by one of the women that you are ministering to and care for. Sometimes that's very difficult for you then to cope with. It's distressing to hear about it. You're pained for them. You are unable to sleep and to get your mind off the subject, which keeps running around and around in the head. You don't know how to analyse it, to understand it, to do anything with it, and you're a mess. And I've seen some girls on the staff sometimes being messed up for 3-4 days from the kind of story they have been told by somebody else. Now, you've got to have some kind of offloading system to actually deal with it. At that point, you need help then in terms now. Don't go and talk to everybody about it. That, of course, would be a terrible break in confidence. But I don't think it's a breach in confidence to come and talk to someone like myself about it in order to help you cope with the information and then deal with it with a person. Quite often you can talk to me about it without telling me who the person is, just to be able to go through the case as a case to help you deal with the issue. But it's sometimes needed for that. You've got to judge very carefully, though, as to what you say to whom you share information. We've got to think very carefully. Now, I think in this last year we've done fairly well. There have been very few breaches of confidentiality in the last year or so, to which I congratulate you and I'm very thankful. Most years we have an accident, and that's difficult. But when you know that we're dealing on the personal lives of over 1,000 people, to have one accident is not bad going in a year. There's a lot of very personal information that is shared with us by members of congregations. We need to deal with that information with enormous care and concern. Now, most of it you need never say to anybody about anything, do you? You just got to learn how to keep it to yourself. But it's difficult. You know, people tell me they're going to get engaged in 3 weeks' time, and then I can't remember whether it's public or not. And so then other people ask me about whether I think they are, and I can't remember one way or another, although I know they are, but I can't remember whether I'm supposed to know whether they are or not. And life gets very tricky at times when you're told things, Al. Just best not to say anything, yes? Thank you, it's a good rule of thumb. Because those kinds of things don't need to be shared, really. And people get very iffy about them. I do not need or want to hear everything that you are told. However, there are sometimes that there are things that I do need to know, especially in relationships to decisions about people and appointments. And so you've got to weigh up, what does Philip need to know about people? Because I take it as with any organisation in confidentiality, if a junior member of staff is told anything, then the person who is telling them that should assume that that information may be passed on to a senior member of staff. Please don't tell me everything. I don't want a rerun of every conversation you have. I don't need to know everything about every member of the congregation. I mean, life would be unbearable. It gets hard enough as it is already, is that right? But if you know a member of the congregation's a homosexual and has actually had trouble with paedophilia, then it is helpful for me to know before I appoint them as a Sunday school teacher, isn't it? Just might be a useful piece of information for me to have when it comes around to being inviting them to do a special children's club and take the little boys away for a camping week. Could have told me beforehand. That would have helped. So you do have to think and say, this is a piece of information which really needs to be told to Philip. It's always best to get the person to tell me rather than you tell me, isn't it? That is always a better move. Say, look, this is something we really should raise with, it may not be with me, it may be with, you know, Archie if you're working in GBF or whoever the appropriate senior member of staff is. But say, it'd be better, why don't you and I go and we'll talk it over with them? The risk with that is the person will say, no, I don't want you to tell them under any circumstances, which then makes it much more difficult for you to say it behind their back. But you do need to work out where your obligations lie. Sometimes you don't need to tell me. But other times you should. We've got to show disinterest in gossip. And we've got to set that as a model within congregational life. So you're hanging around with a group of people and they start gossiping, you must be the person who stops it. Take the initiative in stopping it. Be the first person to say, oh, look, that's not very helpful to talk about other people like that. Let's move on to another subject. You must be the person who stops gossip. And therefore, of course, you must not be the person who does gossip. It's very difficult for Christians because we're interested in people and we're interested in each other and we're interested in what's happening to each other. And the definition of gossip is pretty hard. I don't know if you've ever sat down and tried to define gossip, but it's pretty hard to define it. But it can ruin churches. So and the Bible's very strongly against gossip. We mustn't share complaints about other staff members. If people have got a problem with a staff member, get them to talk to the staff member directly. Don't start up the complaint list of staff members. We've got to defend each other against accusations. Now, I guess this is me defending myself as much as anything else, isn't it? Because the one they're going to complain about most is me, and you've got to defend me more than most. But if they've got a legitimate complaint, then either you need to raise it with me, or you need to get them to raise it with me. But remember, I can only cope with so many. You know, try and space them out, one a week or something rather than putting them all on the same day. One of our problems, though, within each other here is that we threaten each other from time to time. And we mustn't allow the evil one to divide us from each other. We've got to work with each other. I don't know whether you know it or not, but I guess you do. The people on our staff are enormously capable, able and talented. And the crazy part is, they're sufficiently intelligent by and large to realise that about everybody else except themselves. And so they see each other doing wonderfully clever things and able things, and they start entering into competition, and if they've got low self-esteem, into feeling defeated and that they're not as good as each other, and have a terrible time with each other at times. And of course that's just the evil one trying to work against us. When you see one of the other staff members doing something really good, praise God. Don't be jealous, don't be envious, don't enter into rivalry, don't be concerned he's getting more notice than I am or something like that. Just be thankful to God that God has given such a clever, such an able, such a gifted, such a talented minister of the gospel to the same cause you're in. Praising God for each other is very important, and praying for each other is important. All right. There's one last quick topic to deal with that I'll deal with, and we'll pick up the other ones the next night. Alcohol. People in public ministry need to be very judicious about what they drink in front of whom. You never know when you may be in the eye of an alcoholic or a legalist. Be conservative and private. Thoughtful at all times. What will you do? What you do will affect far more people than you could imagine. Alcohol is one of the big diseases of our society. It's a much bigger problem than drug abuse, heroin abuse and all those kinds of things. They're nothing compared to alcohol. Absolutely nothing. And our position in leadership is observed in this area more than talked about, more than taught. If we drink alcohol, the whole congregation will drink alcohol. If we don't drink alcohol, many of the congregation will be conservative in their alcohol usage. And so it's fairly important. So I don't want to walk into staff members' homes and find the wine rack right in front of the front door. I mean, that is a very big, loud statement about our Christian liberty and freedom, which we are free to have. But on the other hand, what does it say when the alcoholic in our congregation walks into the room? And they will. What does it say to those who come from legalistic backgrounds that think alcohol is sinful? And you will have some. That's not a helpful message to people. It also is not a helpful message to people who haven't yet formed any opinion on alcohol. So we have to be just wary and cautious about where and when and what we drink. I am of Christian liberty on the matter. That is, I am free to drink and free not to drink. I have many Christian friends who drink and I have many Christian friends who don't drink. But you may as well know, I hate the grog industry. So if I have a tendency, it is to detestation, just a tad tendency, right, of the whole industry, because I've seen it destroy so many lives. And therefore, I do want you to be particularly responsible about this area. I've noticed at St. Barney's Broadway that there is a laxer attitude towards alcohol in the staff. And I've noticed at Sydney University that it's riddled all through EU. You know, go to 21st birthday parties over Sydney University and they're all giving each other bottles of wine for the 21st birthday parties. And I think it's a very funny thing for Christians to be giving other Christians bottles of plonk, and it just seems to me bizarre. Christians have fought against alcohol abuse for 200 or 300 years, when no one else in our society would do so. To see the leaders of a Christian movement giving each other grog for 21st birthday parties, you know, I really found it awful. I just couldn't. I mean, the founding fathers of the EU, who are all the teetotal, temperance alliance people, they'd be spinning in their graves if they thought that's what Sydney University EU had reached its position at. I mean, they were wrong because they were legalists. And I think the problem comes from the staff members. Not that they're preaching it or teaching it, but just their attitude towards it and the way they do it openly and flagrantly. Now, I don't want you to be hypocrites. If you drink alcohol, you drink alcohol, that's perfectly all right. But I want you to, you must now drink in the cupboard. I'm not saying that. Right? Be what you are and be honest and open about what you are. That's perfectly all right. But be discreet, be careful. Remember, you are ministering to people all the time now. Not just when you're on show, but all the time. And you're associating with a man who is the last of the great grog haters. Because I really can't stand grog. One of the few things that really gets on my goat is grog. Most drowning accidents, apart from the children drowning, but most adult drowning accidents occur because of grog. It's not put down that. People, X number of people drown, but you check the statistics and you'll find that 80, 90% of them had grog. It's a real problem in our society. Most marriage breakups, you'll find grog. It is one of the great devastations of our society, but no one will open up and say it. So, you are dealing with someone who's a bit of a fanatic on the subject, I know. So you don't want to enter into argument about that and discussion about that. What we're going to do is pray and go home so we can come back rejoicing in the morning of having a wonderful night's sleep. Listing in payments in terms of desperation levels. And it is a great help to the whole organisation, for those who have got money behind them, if you don't mind being paid last on the list. It is a sadness that we are like this, but then again, it's the reality. And Jesus warns us not to be anxious about money in Matthew 6. In the coming days, I think it is going to be hard. In previous days, when I got ordained, there were churches with money that could pay for you, and it never occurred to me much that I wouldn't be paid. Gone are those days. A third of the parishes of the Diocese of Sydney really should be in the hands of the receivers. They're surviving, but only just. We want you to be planting new churches that don't yet exist, and to be raising up more money. God will provide for his servants as he continues to do so, but you can't expect to be well paid, although I don't expect any of you to starve for the sake of the gospel. But it's always going to be tight, and you're going to have to learn how to live a fairly tight and measured lifestyle. The options all the time is to go out and earn money doing other things. But you can only go out and earn money doing other things by reducing ministry, cutting back on ministry. That's the problem with it. And so there's all kinds of ways in which I've devised to make money over the years. I'm actually fairly good at it, but I can only do that by cutting down on Christian ministry, which seems to me to defeat the purpose of what I'm trying to be on about. And so you've got to learn not to be greedy for money when there'll be certain financial pressures upon you. Because of this, you must never put yourself in a position of temptation or be seen to be in a position of temptation or compromise. Lots of money pass through our hands. Enormous quantities of money, actually, will pass through our office in a course of a year. I guess the turnover in the office, MTS, congregations, mid-year conferences, setting up to $1.5 million, something like that. There's all kinds of money floating around. Put the bookstall out and the tapes and the rest of it. And it wouldn't be all that very hard to kind of see $50 of it your way en route and no one notice it. We've got fairly good auditing systems, we've got fairly tight controls, but anyone who wants to put their mind to taking money, it's easy to do.
But I don't think Christian workers fall that way, basically. They tend to fall by carelessness about money rather than by setting out to take it. And therefore, you've got to be very careful. The money's, in the boxes. You must never take out of the boxes. You must never touch them. You must always ask the layman to empty it. The money's being counted in the back room. You must never be in there counting the money in the back room. You must not be part of that scene. I mean, sometimes you've got to walk into the room, you're carrying something in there. Well, by all means, you carry it in, you put it down, you say hello to the blokes who are counting the money, you walk out. You don't spend time hanging around where the money is. We mustn't allow the evil one to point an accusing finger at any member of staff because he's, handling the money, near the money, or close to the money. We've got to avoid any touch of the money. We have rules about the counting of the money. There's always got to be two people counting the money. Sometimes there's not a second person left in the church building. If that is the case, you may act as a witness for the other person to lock the money up so that two people can count the money later. Right? But don't get involved in counting it yourself. It's better to leave it locked in the plastic boxes. Better let it be stolen by somebody walking past the church and breaking in than for you to be putting it in your back pocket to give it to the church later. You don't have it. You mustn't go near it in any way. The one place where we have exceptions to it is the selling of books and tapes down at the office. All right? We do receive monies there. Where else do we receive money? Sometimes some of us will be receiving deposits for mid-year conference. Would that be another way we'd receive money? At house parties, we shouldn't count the money. We should get one of the lay people to count the money and be... If you're running a house party, first thing to do is to find a treasurer and let them handle the money. Let them do the counting, the banking and the receiving of the money. But sometimes you do have to receive deposit money and sometimes books and tapes we're selling in the chaplaincy. But you do need to be very careful about that and keep the records very clear so that no accusations can be levelled against you. The evil one loves to bring accusations against ministers in this regard. And so just be very, very careful. It's only small amounts of money in a sense, but that doesn't matter. You be scrupulous about money. You be scrupulous about it. In terms of your own financial arrangements, we try our hardest, and we cannot succeed, in being fair and equitable to everybody, and we can't succeed because we don't have enough money to be able to do it. Different ones of us are working on different schemes in terms of the finances that we're under operation here. If you're on the staff, you are no longer at liberty to receive money for your ministry. That is, you've got to have the one source by which you are being paid and refuse all others. Not just with us now. I mean, what I'm talking about is what's happening here. What I'm trying to do is lay down foundations for you for the next 40 years. Let me illustrate it for myself. I am paid by the church wardens of St. Matthias Centennial Park. They know my full financial position, they know my needs, and they pay me according to the basic rates of the Anglican Church demands that they pay me, and I try and talk them out of paying me any more, and they try to talk me into receiving more. And so we have a general fight with each other every 6 months or so, as they try and work out ways in which they can pay me more, and I try and work out ways in which they don't have to pay me more, because I know that if they start paying me more and everybody else more, then we can't put on more staff because we haven't got enough money. I'd prefer to have another staff member than me being paid above ward wages. And I've been fighting with them for a long time now. That is the way the fight should be conducted. It is very bad when the church wardens are fighting to pay you less and the clergyman's fighting to be paid more. Much better to be living in the situation where the clergyman is fighting to be paid less and the church wardens are fighting to pay more, isn't it? So that everyone's being generous is a much better way to go. I also can receive money from lots of other sources. Speaking engagements. Last year's trip through America, the honorariums I was paid for my trip through America, taking my wife with me for 8 weeks. If I'd hung around certain churches, I could have made a lot of money. I think in one church, I can't remember, Tony will remember better than I will, I was only there morning and evening, only preached twice, three times. And I think they gave us a check for $1,200 American. You can make a lot of money in America. I could also make a lot of money now as a convention speaker. Every time you speak up a convention, Katoomba convention, you get paid hundreds of dollars. I can also get paid from the royalties of my books and from everything that I do through St. Matthias Press. I also lecture at Moore College and can get paid for lecturing over at Moore College. I can also set and mark examination papers for the external studies of Moore College and get paid there. You can get paid for weddings and for funerals. The current rate is $100, I think, a funeral, and a clergyman close by here had 15 in a week. That's $1,500 for weeks funerals. It's a nice little earner, as Arthur would say. If you put your mind to it, you can make a lot of money in religion. If you put your mind to it. Japanese weddings. Big money. $3,000 per wedding, and you can do two or three a week. Building like this, they'd charge it. Ted Knopf was doing it up at Wayside Chapel. Scandalised people. But wouldn't scandalise too many people these days. You can make money, you see. I receive no monies other than what the church wardens pay me. Everything else that I am given, I am offered, I return and ask the people to give it to the church wardens who pay my salary. Even travelling. I go to speak at somewhere, they give me a travelling money, I say, thank you very much, I'll give that to the church wardens, they're paying my travelling allowance. The travelling allowance I'm paid is adequate for all the travelling I do. Therefore, why should I be receiving money from someone else for travelling? I'm being paid for what I need, therefore, I give all monies else. So I am not at liberty to receive any money from anybody for the ministry I exercise. All monies I receive, I give to the church wardens who pay me. Now, you see what that does for me? It frees me, liberates me enormously, because I know I'm never going to receive any money, so I don't sit there wondering about it. It means I never choose to speak at a place because it's a good-paying place to go to. It means no one can buy me to preach any particular message anywhere that they want me to. Right? I am free from a whole range of temptations and a whole range of manipulations because there's only one people who pay me and they know exactly what I'm being paid. They know me down to my last penny, really. It means that I am then accountable in that sense of the word, that my life is an open book at this point and the wardens can be safe guarded that they're not employing a shyster. Now, that's a very helpful thing. Because of the kindness of God, the wardens we have here, I am particularly open and frank with. I don't know whether I'd always be as open as frank with everybody, but Robert Tong is one of our wardens here, and I knew Robert before I went to kindergarten. He was best man at my wedding, and he has got power of attorney over my affairs. So there really isn't much point keeping any secrets from somebody who is like that, is there? You don't always get that fortune in life. But I'm saying we're not free to receive money from anybody. It's a principle of life. weddings, funerals, baptisms. I've never received money from any of them. I will not receive money from them. The first day I made that policy decision was in this church, was the week I arrived here. I took a wedding only about a month or so later. And this couple had just been converted. Weddings in those days cost about, you got about $20. He gave me $400. But I'd made the policy, so I just handed the $400 over to the church. It's surprising how temptation comes. Yeah? If he'd given me $20, I would have thought nothing. I just handed it over to the church. He gave me $400, I thought, is that really a good policy? Yeah. I could do a lot of things with this. You know, maybe I should rethink this. Give it over to the church. Have the fixed, firm policy in your head. Never vary on it. Never vary. The fact that you can't be bought is important, especially in some kinds of churches. Beware of Greeks bearing gifts, is the old saying. I've noticed it in several churches where very wealthy people give a motor car. You know, they're trading in their car. Rather than trading, they'll give it to the minister. I would never accept it. I'd never accept it. I'd say, why don't you sell that car and put the money into the church? But I wouldn't accept the money. I wouldn't accept the motor car. Because if I've got this man's motor car I'm driving around, how will I actually be able to disagree with him when it comes to a church policy issue? For rest assured, the day will come when we're having a fight in the church and he will expect me to be on his side because I'm driving his car. He must never be bought by money. And the way to do it is never accept anything other than your salary. Now, while you're on MTS, you're not getting much salary, are you? But that's life. Now, if you can't live on it, then you've got to negotiate it with MTS. But don't negotiate it. Don't have other accesses. What happens if a member of your family wants to give you money? Well, that's different. You take the money from your family, because they're not giving it to you because of your ministry, they're giving it to you because you're their son, their daughter, their nephew, their niece, their granddaughter, whatever it might be. That's a different kettle of fish. What happens if it's a member? What happens about a church member wanting to give you money? No, we're socialist at this point. We're saying we know roughly how much the church is going to give in this year, and we have decided how to allocate that in the best way across the staff members the church is employing. And therefore, if there is a church member who wants to give more, encourage them to give to the church rather than to you. But you're not at liberty to receive money, especially from any of our church members. What if you go and speak at a house party somewhere and they offer you some travelling money to be there? If you're on MTS, take the travelling money and keep it for yourselves, but declare it to Tony or to Paul, right? You won't be docked anything more about it, but by declaring it just keeps you honest and accountable. So if they give you $400 to travel to North Sydney, well, yes, we'll talk to you about the fact that it didn't cost $400 and that should go to MTS. But if you've gone to Maru and they're giving you, you know, $20 to cover your expenses getting there and back, well, of course, we want you to keep the $20 to get there and back. If they give you a present like a book or something like that, yes, by all means, keep it. But always, for your own conscience sake and for accusations later, it's helpful just to mention it to somebody. It's no big deal, but you get in the practice of doing it, then you never have problems with it. And so I do it on little things. Sometimes I've had to do it on very big things. But when people make donations, so when I retired from Katoomba Convention, after whatever it was, 20 years running Katoomba Conventions, I'd never received any money from them for the work I did. St Matthias had received money because they paid honorariums, but I kept on saying they had to pay it to St Matthias, not me. But when I came to retire from it, against my wishes, they took us out to dinner and gave us a big whack-up do, which was all very pleasant and lovely of them. But they also gave to us a nice sound system, I don't know what you call it, record player and CD and all that kind of thing, because we, Helen and I have never actually owned one. And they found out that we never owned one, even though we like music, so they kindly donated that to us as a present. I don't know how much they cost, not the faintest clue. I never walk into shops to have a look at those kinds of things, and I certainly don't look now that they've given it to me. But I couldn't accept it without first clearing it with the church wardens. Wouldn't be right. Now, of course, what do the church wardens say? They say, that's wonderful, marvellous. You know, can we buy a CD for you? I mean, that's they're as happy as Larry. But I am not going to receive gifts from people, even an organisation that I've served for 20 years and are giving me a retirement gift. I'm not free to receive gifts from anybody. And that saves me from ever playing favourites with rich people and things like that. Which they can't, I can never play favourites. There's no point playing favourites with rich people. I can't receive gifts from them. What around about Christmas time when people come around and give you some gifts? Accept them and be glad, and please don't tell us about them. But if it's substantial, if it's something that's not just, you know, a box of chocolates or a night at the movies or something rather, if it's something that's of considerable value, talk to us about it. Don't just accept it. You be very careful. Money is a terrible, greed is a terrible, terrible disease. And people unwittingly compromise you. And you unwittingly get compromised. So you don't take money in any ways. We can't finance people through theological education. We can't help you very much financially, and we're sorry about it. We try our best, and we try to raise the money. We try our best in distributing it equitably. We try our best in making sure that those in greatest need get the most help. But we do not have enough money. Or the other way of putting it, God gives us more people than he gives us money. We are a very people-rich congregation and work, and although it sounds like huge amounts of money we're dealing with, it's not huge amounts of money considering the amount of things that we're doing. There are about 60 people, 50 people on the staff telephone list. When you realise that, you realise the $1.5 million we're talking about is not an enormous amount of money. That's a very small turnover for what's a fairly large company. There's our problem. You must understand that the church is not a bottomless pit of money. And so therefore you can't just keep on spending congregation money as if it's endlessly there. It's, you know, the St. Matthias is not a milch cow that we just can keep on buying things. It's pretty well tied up in terms of the expenditure. If you need to spend things, you've got to do it through Tony, and he's a well-known, mean kind of administrator at certain points. But don't run off assuming that St. Matthias will pick up the tab on, you know, you've got a great scheme for a house party, so you run a house party, but you run it at a big loss, but don't worry about it, St. Matthias is going to pay. We don't have any money. We don't have any reserves. I think only about four or five times in the last 15 years have the year finished in the black. We've been in the red every other time, usually by less than 1%. In a budget of about 700,000, we'll be about 1% out or something like that, which we carry in the next year and so on. But there is no kind of bank account anywhere that we could just raid and bail you out of making a financial mess. So that doesn't exist either. You've got to be clear about it. And it's a good thing to learn back generally. We are living on Christian people's money. Therefore, we must respect it and be sure that people do not feel that we are wasting their money. I have no guilt about eating steak. But if I ate steak every night, I would have a difficulty, I think, in terms of my relationship with the congregation, many of whom are not eating steak because they're putting the money in the plate to keep me alive. But I live at the standard, just marginally below the standard of the congregation, seems to me to be an appropriate kind of place to be pitching your lifestyle at. Now, there's no reason to be living in the abject poverty end of the congregation, but you certainly mustn't be living in the above average side of the congregational life either. That's just not appropriate. And therefore our expenditure needs to be careful because people are paying for it. Sometimes people don't understand how much money we have behind us for other reasons. See, some of us come from very wealthy families, and so we have money that's got nothing to do with what the congregation's paying and therefore can afford to own all kinds of things. But even that you've got to be careful about. One of the minister friends I know was given, I think Derek was working for him at the time, he was given, wasn't he, Derek, a Mercedes. Was it given us or something like that, or did he buy it? But it worked out to be a much cheaper deal than driving a Holden. It was an old Mercedes. But considering the lifespan of Mercedes and their reliability and a whole range of other things, he was far better off than owning the Holden Kingswood that he kind of owned before. He drove it around for a while. He sold it in the end because people could not cope with a minister driving a Mercedes. It just wasn't right, even though the economics was all right. And he could point out how it was cheaper for him to be driving this Mercedes than to be buying a Holden. But you can drive a Holden as a minister and no one's worried about it. But you drive a Mercedes, doesn't seem right. Conspicuous consumption is something you've got to avoid in Christian ministry, and we need to be careful. I think they're the issues on money. What else do you want to raise about money? Queries or questions you want to ask? Always be open and frank about it and speak your mind. It doesn't worry me about money. Because I'm not free to receive it, I never receive. I say to them, look, thank you so much. I'm glad that you want to contribute to the ministry of the gospel. I'm not at liberty to receive money because I'm fully paid for by my church. They look after all my needs. But our church looks after lots of people who do need money. So do you mind if I pass it on to the church, or would you like me to give it back to you? 99 times out of 100, they say, oh, no, you give it to the church. I say, okay. But I always want to do that so they don't think they've given it to me and so that they know that I have given it to the church kind of thing, right? Yes, sometimes one time I was coming home from a midyear conference. I was being driven home from a midyear conference with a man, and on the trip he reached into his pocket and pulled out his bank account and gave me his bank book and said, here's the money in my account. I really can't, in the face of what I've learnt this week, live knowing I own all this money. Why don't you take it and use it for whatever purpose you want to? So I gave it back to him. Because I don't think he'd understood Christian responsibility. He'd been touched in his heart by the gospel, and that was wonderful and lovely. But he hadn't understood yet that the rich young ruler, having given away all that he had to follow Jesus, would have been given it back. So I gave it back to him. Yes. Yeah, I redirect it. I often tell them to give it to MTS. Yeah, the recycling of money in the Christian community is a funny one, I always think. You know, I mean, every time it goes around, Paul Keating gets another bit of it. A bit stupid in some ways, isn't it? In church services where people pass the plate, I've noticed over the years that people like bishops and visiting preachers always make a point of contributing. And at one level that's good, but I can never do it because it always worries me about Matthew chapter 6 in terms of not letting your right hand know what your left hand's doing. I like the direct deposit system of giving because I can do what I can do and no one knows what I'm doing except the bank who doesn't give a fig. So that's how I've organised my financial life. And so I never put anything in the boxes here and never seem to put anything in the boxes here. It would always worry me a bit if I did because I'd be worried about people watching me and seeing me doing it. So I never do it. Yeah, that's a bit funny, isn't it? Giving to MTS when you're paid by MTS, isn't it? Yeah, well, you give to church and you're paid by the church. It's a kind of funny thing. The giving is a principle of generosity. And learning generosity is a good thing. If it feels just a bit too stupid to be giving to MTS when we're paid by MTS, then give to CMS. And hope that our friends in CMS are giving to MTS. The money changing around the... You know... It's a bit crazy, isn't it? Yep. Close friends in the church are church members that should be encouraged to give to the church. Close members outside of the church, yeah, we want to encourage more and more of those through Col and Ruth working in the office to be encouraging them to be giving to MTS so that more people like yourselves can be employed and so that you can be employed and so we can pay you on time and things like that. And so we do want you to start to learn how to raise money in the 2 years you're with us through MTS because that's needed to be done. Yes, if you're doing part-time work, and some of us, of course, are doing it here or down the track, if you did some tent making in order to church plant or something like that, the money you make making the tents is the money for you to determine what you do with and how much you charge and what you do with is completely your own because it's got nothing to do with ministry. One of the problems is letting go of that work so as to trust wholly in other people providing for you. And the work that you do can take over your life fairly easily. And so some people I've seen do it long term can never actually give up earning the money and earning the big money. And of course, to chase the big money requires you to put more hours in and, you know, the ministry gets squeezed out. However, the integrity questions are different when you're earning the money for tent making. You're earning the money for tent making. But I see, if you're earning enough by tent making, I don't think you can then ask the congregation to be giving to you. Because they say, well, you're earning, we're earning. At the intermediate step, it's quite hard to juggle as to how much you're paying, you the congregation are paying for me and how much I'm earning myself and how I can phase out working while I increase the amount of working I do in church because you're giving me some money. It's quite tricky to do.
And then sort of correlating to that is the money that you may have on investment as a result of church making.
Yes.
Returns that you get from those investments.
Yes.
Whilst 100% in
ministry. Yes. That's right. Yeah, well, that's just God's good fortune that he has bestowed upon you that you've got to use responsibly. That's, you know, there's It's also got to do with, you know, how you've used them over years. So, for various reasons, Helen worked hard when and saved hard when I was going through college, and my mother died and left me some money, and we combined and bought a place, and we lived mean most of our lives, and so we've paid off the place, we sold the place and bought another place, and we now rent that place out, and we're negative geared to the hilt to pay off this other place, and so we have all this kind of thing going on, which has got nothing to do with the congregation and their giving money to us. That's just got to do with our business now. But every now and then, I have to pull myself back from turning it into a real business. Because I could spend a lot of time doing this. I could actually go into real estate in a big way. I don't need to. All I'm doing is providing for my retirement, that's all. Because I want to retire in the eastern suburbs. So that's all I'm doing. So therefore, I'm actually making consciously, economically irrational decisions. Because I don't want that thing to be taking over my life or controlling my life. Yet I am, at the same time, using the resources God's given me to provide for my family, or my widow. Yes. Christian responsibility with money is very tricky. It's easier in one sense to be poor, easier mentally to be poor. But that's why this bloke wanted to just give his bank book to me. Right? That's not the answer. The answer is to learn how to juggle your responsibilities without getting caught up in the greed and the activities of it, but to be thankful to God that he has given you those assets and resources to be used for his benefit. So it's a tricky one.
What if you don't get paid from NTA and could raise funds to support yourself? What if DSN pays directly to you or to the NTA and then pays you?
Do you hear that question and understand it, Cole?
Yeah. Generally, we're encouraging you to get your supporters to pay it through NTS. That links them into NTS support long term, so that they might keep supporting Korean NTS workers or generally NTS after you finish with us.
It also means that there is an account system of the amount of money that you're receiving. So people give to you thinking that they are the only giving to you. Then they find out someone else was giving to you. And then somebody else, and then somebody else. And they thought, now I was giving to you because you're really poor, but you're getting money from six or seven other people. And what controls are there? By giving to an organisation that pays you, then they have some control over what is happening to money and some auditing, accountability to the money. Furthermore, when people are employed by MTS, we look after some of the other details, don't we? Tax things and so on. Because if you're being given money for ministry, you are being paid. Now here is, of course, the tax laws are a mess as far as we're concerned. Because when is a gift a gift and when is it an honorarium and when is it a wage when it comes to Christian ministry? I mean, if I wanted to, I could actually pay no tax. No difficulty rigging out tax systems so as to avoid paying tax altogether, if you really put your mind to it in terms of Christian. I mean, I trust friends enough to receive no salary and just let my friends, drop pumpkins over the back fence. I mean, there'd be no difficulty for me living that way and not being able to pay a penny tax. Now, that's not right. I've got to do the right thing. And so, again, being paid through a system enables you to be an employee and all the matters above board, so there's no hint and scope for immorality on the finances, which seems to us to be important. Darren? Yes. The fellows can tell you about the details, is that right? Kirsty? exactly that way. You don't have much money, you want to be generous, and you've got to be sensible. You got it. Now balance. And different ones of us will balance in different ways. Some of us say, look, I don't give a fig about whether I'm in a private ward or a public ward. You know, it just doesn't worry me. And so I'm happy to just go along with the public health system. Others will say, you know, I really couldn't cope with that. I'd prefer to have a choice of my doctor. I'd prefer to pay for that and not have as much money to spend on ice creams. The freedom of choice of how Christians handle, that's the freedom of choice, and there'll be differences within the staff as to where you make those choices, I think.
You said that you know how to make lots of money in real estate, and there'll be other Christians who know how to make lots of money. Is it ethical for us to encourage people we trust or who we know are good Christians or mature to make lots of money
Oh, yes, nothing wrong with that. But I don't think you should do it if you're in full-time ministry, because it just takes over your life. It's a great snare. Greed is a terrible snare. And you think you've ripped it out of your heart, and you'll find down the track it's still in there. You know, I remember 10, 15 years after I'd gone in the ministry, I went to visit an old university friend that went through university with Helen and myself, and we went to visit his home, and it was up at Castle Hill Way on a 5-acre block, and you know, it just went on and on and on and on, and it was lovely in every proportion, in every direction. Although it had one funny feature. The bathroom wall, the exterior wall of the bathroom, was all glass, without any curtains or blinds or anything. And it overlooked a bushland setting, so then there was no way anybody could look in. It was up a kind of a second floor. You couldn't see it from outside anything, but it just didn't feel right somehow to be all in your kind of resplendent glory looking out over the bush. I don't know why it felt wrong, but it just didn't feel right. It was the only failing, I thought, in the whole house, and even that was kind of memorable. And suddenly, envy and greed and disappointment of, if I hadn't gone into ministry, this is where I'd be living next door to this man, owning just this kind of house, just doing, with a kind of toilet. But he, I thought myself, I'd made this great choice of sacrifice, but I had not made the choice at all yet. I was still hanging on to it in my heart, wasn't I? Wasn't until that moment that I felt it again. Yeah, greed is very deep-seated in us, friends. Very deep-seated. Beware of it. All right.
We do very well in this area, friends, because we work at it. It's not something I want to preach about. When you do preach about it, it nearly always backfires. We came very close to the line at the Midgee Conference this year on leggings. In our questions, it's a very hard subject to speak of and not be misunderstood. And yet, modesty, both financially and sexually, is an important expression of Christian fellowship. And the way in which we dress as Christians should be observable. Just like the way in which we speak should be observably Christian. That is, we shouldn't have foul talk, please through the mouth. We shouldn't have unseemly jokes. I mean, that's part of it. Ephesians chapter 5 says that. And clothing, you see, is mentioned for us in 1 Timothy 2, in 1 Peter 3, and so on. The way in which we teach our congregations is by modelling this point. What the leadership wears is what everybody else goes to wear. People judge the standard of appropriate dress basically by the company they keep. And so in any group, you watch the people come the first time not sure of what they should wear. The second time they've pretty well got exactly the same kind of things that everybody else has got to wear. Therefore, the way in which to control the modesty level in a congregation is to make sure that the leadership always dressed appropriately. And so therefore, while I won't mention it much to the congregation, in fact, I don't ever want to mention it to the congregation except when I'm specifically preaching on those passages that refer to it, I will mention it to you, especially if I think that you're out of line in any area. That's a little embarrassing, a little difficult when it happens, but don't worry, I'll do it. Because if you lower the standards, it goes through the congregation in a flash. And we really can't lose the game here. Dress patterns shift from group to group that you're dealing with, from age to age in time. And what Paul says is we must be all things to all men, that we may by all means save some. And therefore you've got to be conscious of what you're wearing. If you come into morning church, they dress a tad more conservatively than evening church, who are a tad more conservative than the uni church. Although the sexual immorality, kind of the erotic dressing, is a little bit more in, I think, in PM church than the uni church. I think the uni church are just a little bit more morally conservative. But Sunday evening church have got more money, and they dress a little bit better. Combining those two congregations is going to have a certain dynamic effect in terms of dress sense. The students, I suspect, will need to dress a tad better than they have previously. The great ones for the barefoot college look, which may not be as quite as appropriate in Unisearch House as it has been in CLB. On the other hand, the Sunday night church may need to dress in a little bit more relaxed fashion. But you come in morning church, then I think you need to dress a little bit better. I think if you go to KBF, you need to dress a bit better. Koreans, I think, are more fastidious dressers than the other congregations. The Greeks, Archie, what have the Greeks done? They used to dress up to the nine pins, but they don't anymore. It used to be over the top, wasn't it? Yeah, but you need to learn as you go. Now, if you go to visiting another church, you've got to learn. See, I'll put on a suit if I'm going to another church. If you go to certain churches, I put on a clerical collar. I haven't been to one for the last 5 years, and so my collar doesn't fit me anymore. But if need be, I'd do it. I'd borrow Derek's. But you've got to adapt your style to the people that you're with, but generally we must keep wearing dress that is appropriate and respectable. Right? And it is a matter of concern that we dress appropriately. Sometimes, fellows, you've got to watch what you're wearing in terms of tracksuit trousers, and sometimes you've got to be careful in terms of swimwear. Fellows are a bit stupid about that sometimes because they just don't think about it. It's not so much that it's erotically arousing to the women, although for some women it's a problem. More it's something that they find disgusting and repulsive. And it's still something that you need to pay attention to and just not... The girls work very hard on our behalf, fellows. It's very difficult for them because women are so fiercely competitive on dress sense. Fiercely competitive. And we say to our women, accept a handicap. Don't wear the latest gear. Right? Which means they almost start as losers in the competition because they're not allowed to wear the very latest thing, because the very latest thing is always erotic. That's what makes it acceptable to you in a minute. When short skirts are no longer become erotic, then you wear long skirts with big slits up them. So, and what makes the long skirt with a big slit? It's the eroticism of being able to look right up the leg, you see. It's always erotic. Whatever the latest fashion is, it's erotic. And so we're always asking the girls to be fashionably dressed, but not the latest fashion, and to compete with the world, but not to really win. It's very difficult for them.
And I think sometimes fellows can be a bit insensitive when they pay so little attention to their clothing and to their attire. But it is important that our congregations continue in the high reputation that they already experience and enjoy as being modest. And we really do. And when I go to other congregations sometimes, I'm appalled at what I see in terms of the laxity of behaviour, of language, of vulgarity, and of immodesty. The whole things get combined together. They all get wrapped up together. Dirty stories are never part of Christian thinking and Christian action. And they are an unloving way of thinking about other people. It is not to be part of our lifestyle. So Ephesians 5 is clear on it. And so we should be observably Christian. And I think in this kind of area of life, we do very well. And the reason we all do very well is because the staff keeps on getting ticked about it by me. Because if the staff do the right thing, I've noticed the rest of the church basically does the right thing. But as soon as the staff lower the standards, it's like wildfire. It just passes through person after person. They follow the fashion in the wrong direction. It's very hard to lift standards, very easy to drop them.